This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 300 rare mountain gorillas, that's about half of the world's surviving population, live in the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest National Park in Uganda. Dr. Craig Stanford is an anthropologist who studies gorillas and chimpanzees there. He hasn't been back to the park since a few days before the massacre of Western tourists last March. You probably heard part of the story. On March 1st, the park was attacked by about 100 members of the Hutu Intihamwe rebels, who were also behind the Rwandan genocide. They burned down many of the tourist camps, killed one of the park wardens, and kidnapped 14 people, mostly Western tourists who had paid to observe mountain gorillas. Stanford's field assistant was one of the hostages. The hostages were divided into two groups. One group was murdered. The other was allowed to live. Stanford's assistant survived. Craig Stanford teaches at the University of Southern California. I spoke to him from Los Angeles. He told me he found out about the attack shortly after he left Uganda and returned home.
I run a research project that has a small camp that's located about 8 miles into the forest away from the tourism center, Buhoma, where the attack happened. And so we stay there. I have some Ugandan field assistants who are permanently based there. And Mitchell Kiever was my current foreign research assistant coming from Calgary in Canada. I had left that camp, passing through the tourist camp, about 10 days earlier before the attack. And Mitch had actually taken me back to Kampala, and I had then flown home to L.A. And then I got an email on the morning of March 1st, because I get up during the night to work a lot on my computer, and I got an email about 4 in the morning from a colleague in Rwanda saying, just said, attack at Buhoma, no details right now, more later. And so that didn't tell me very much. I thought maybe it meant there was a bandit attack, you know, just somebody robbing the camp. And then that morning at breakfast, I was called by the Ottawa Foreign Affairs people, who are the equivalent of our State Department, telling me that they thought Mitch was a hostage, which I didn't believe, actually. I thought his agenda would have put him somewhere else that particular day. And then I called his mom and dad, who live on a farm outside of Calgary, and they said, no, we just talked to him on the phone, and in fact, he almost certainly was in that camp the night it was hit, or the morning it was hit. And so I then learned, actually later that day, Uganda time, but it was California time early in the morning on March 1st, that he was a hostage.
So about half of the people taken hostage were murdered, and the other half were released. What condition was the part of the park that the attack took place and left in?
Well, my understanding, and again, I haven't been there since the attack. I was supposed to go back May 1st, and I canceled that trip because the security situation there isn't entirely clear. My understanding is that the camps, it's a dirt road. It's the termination of a long dirt road that you take to get to the park, and then the tourist lodges and the campgrounds and so forth are lined up alongside each side of the dirt road. Is that some of them were damaged and burned. The community campground, which is the $6 a night campground run by the local village folks for backpacking type tourists, that camp was burned. That was where Mitch was staying that night. And in general, the place was kind of ransacked and vehicles blown up and so forth.
This attack must have temporarily totally killed tourism in that area.
Yeah, what happened is that a moratorium was placed on tourism, I mean, an official ban on tourism to that park for 1 month. And, of course, it in the longer term is a terrible thing for Uganda's effort to develop themselves partly via ecotourism. Surprisingly, as soon as the ban on tourism was lifted a month later on April 1st, some tourists did return. The big tourist outfits, Abercrombie & Kent and some of the other safari companies left, and they may return later, but they haven't returned yet. But the more independent kind of travelers, backpackers, and so forth began coming back as soon as the park opened for tourism. Whether that was a smart thing for them to do or not is another question. But tourism has been terribly hurt, not only in Bwindi, the place where the attack happened, but really throughout Uganda. And it is a shame because Uganda, although many Americans, I think, still think of Uganda from the Idi Amin years 20 years ago, Uganda has done a really amazing job of developing, being very pro-West and developing, but not entirely at the expense of their natural resources. They have understood the value of protecting wildlife and wildlife sanctuaries and benefiting from the tourist interest in visiting those places.
Is the tourism good or bad for wildlife in Africa?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good question. For the mountain gorillas, which I'm most familiar with, I think that it's on the whole a good thing, with the proviso that there are many problems involved, and it's certainly a very insecure basis on which to try to protect the 600 remaining mountain gorillas in perpetuity. The reason being that in that part of the world where mountain gorillas still live, there are 300 which live in the Virunga Volcanoes Conservation Area, which is mainly in Rwanda, and then there are 300 in Bwindi, which is entirely within Uganda. It's one of the most biologically fascinating and at the same time politically messed up places on Earth. And that means that any effort to protect the gorilla that assumes that ecotourism dollars will be there, and tourists, when they come to see the gorillas at Bwindi, at least before the attack, were paying up to $240 for a gorilla viewing permit, meaning $240 to spend 1 hour with the gorillas, and a maximum of about 12 to 14 tourists per day were paying that. So it's a lot of money, not to mention all the ancillary money that's laid out. And 20% of that permit fee goes to local villages. So the economic incentive for local people to protect the gorillas, to not harass them, not kill them, not cut down the forest, it was great. And without the tourism, of course, that incentive is removed. And since it all relied on tourism, the conservation effort, I think we realize now that it's not a very stable basis for protecting a critically endangered wildlife species.
Your work in the park is studying chimps and gorillas, and I'm wondering if the chimps and gorillas have been killed or injured during these wars in that part of Africa.
Well, certainly in the Virunga Volcanoes in Rwanda, poaching was an enormous problem back in Diane Fossey's day, meaning poaching for either to get baby gorillas to try to sell to some zoo or something like that, or else poaching for the horrible souvenir trade, meaning to make ashtrays and so forth out of gorilla hands. But death through wars, in the genocidal war in Rwanda in 94, one of the ironies was, regarding wildlife, that something like 800,000 people died and only five gorillas were known to have been killed due directly or indirectly to the military action that was going on there. And that may be partly because both sides, the army and the rebels, recognized that whoever controlled Rwanda would want the tourism dollars that the guerrillas could bring in. So the wars per se don't necessarily kill guerrillas or devastate the guerrilla habitat, but certainly all of the other things were connected to the war, all of the instability that's spread by the war that keeps conservation effort at a minimum or keeps tourism away is just awful for the guerrillas. And recently there's been a terrible problem, of course, with refugees going through the forest in the Virungas and trashing the habitat and things like that.
The park in Bwindi, in which you operate, the park that was also the site of the tourist attack, is in southwestern Uganda. What is the importance of this park environmentally and for the gorillas that live there?
Well, Bwindi is just an absolutely amazing place. And I think most people who have heard of Bwindi or who heard of it before the attack knew it as the place to go see mountain gorillas, and it's been featured in lots of travel sections of major newspapers and so forth. But really, the gorillas may be the most visible wildlife and the most attention-attracting wildlife, but Bwindi is just a tremendous natural treasure for all of Africa and really for the entire world. It's on UNESCO's list of World Heritage Sites, and it's a place that has an extremely high level of species endemism, meaning species that are found nowhere else or almost nowhere else except this 300 and some square kilometer forest. So there are many birds, for instance, that live in the forest at Bwindi that are found in only one or two other forests in the world, and their main breeding populations are in Bwindi. It's a very rugged, high altitude tropical forest. It's 8,000 feet maximum elevation. It's a chilly place. It's not a classic lowland rainforest at all. And there are very few mountainous rainforests left in Africa. So protecting it, not just the gorillas, but all of the wildlife, all the plants and animals, really is a major goal for all the conservation organizations. And losing it, either through loss of the forest or loss of the wildlife, is just an enormous loss for humanity.
And what does it have to be protected from? From developers and from war?
Well, the 300 square kilometers that remain are there only because local people having deforested the area around it. I mean, it's basically an island that sits in the middle of a human sea today. It needs to be protected from further forest cutting, that is, from poaching of the trees that are within the park boundary. The wildlife need to be protected from poaching. There are very few, actually, species and of the larger hoofed animals. There's a very small herd of elephant remaining. There are small populations of antelope and so forth, but there has been a lot of poaching over the years of those animals just by local people for food. So the conservation effort kind of uses gorillas as a flagship animal, but is aimed at protecting the entire forest. And, of course, that's an enormous job. People are hungry. People are very poor. People have very little land for their farms and their families. And so the gorillas were useful for the conservation effort. They still are. Not only to protect them for their own intrinsic value, but also to use them as a flagship to protect the entire forest.
Do a lot of people who live in that area resent the attention that wildlife is getting when the people themselves are so poor and in such need of attention?
Well, I think that would definitely be true if it weren't that tourism dollars that have been coming in were partly given to the local communities. So 20% of every gorilla permit, 20% of every $240 permit went to local villages. So if you walk to a village that's within a few miles of Windy, that village today will have a dispensary or will have some kind of agricultural project going on that wouldn't exist except for the gorilla tourism. And local people, you know, extremely rational as anybody would be, and they realize that there's a real economic incentive here to not harming the gorillas and to not going in and trashing and cutting down the forest. So, again, another way in which tourism has been very valuable there.
Was tourism basically the only source of income for some of the villages that got tourism dollars?
Well, what happened is that the villages around Windy received an economic windfall when tourism began because 20% of the gorilla permit fees began going to those local villages. And those villages over time became pretty dependent on tourism money. So my concern about that area is not only the gorillas, but also that those villages now are destitute because the tourism dollars are going to disappear and so will the percentage going to them. So those villages are farming villages primarily, but I believe that there are an awful lot of people there who did become dependent on tourism, and people were drawn to the area to work as porters, to work in shops and so forth, and to work in jobs connected to the tourist industry. So in that sense, they are quite dependent.
My guest is anthropologist Craig Stanford. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees in a national park in Uganda. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is anthropologist Craig Stanford. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees in the Ugandan National Park, where a group of Western tourists were massacred last March. Will you describe the research that you're doing with chimpanzees and gorillas?
Yeah, what we've been doing for the past 3 years, and I have a history over the past decade of working with chimps in different parts of Africa. I came to Bwindi 3 years ago to set up a project that we call the Bwindi Impenetrable Great Ape Project, and it looks at the relationship between chimpanzees and mountain gorillas. And one of the things that Bwindi is unique for is that it's the only forest on the African continent where you have both mountain gorillas and chimpanzees. And there are many other forests in Africa where you have one or the other, or where you have lowland gorillas and chimpanzees. But Bwindi is the only place where you have these two great apes living in the same forest and sharing the same resources. And so we've been investigating and trying to figure out what's the relationship. Do they compete for food? Some people, we haven't seen this yet, some people have seen gorillas and chimps in the same tree, which is, I'm sure, a spectacular sight, a 400-pound silverback gorilla and chimpanzees way up in the same tree canopy. And do they compete for nesting spots and this sort of thing? And that's an intrinsically interesting set of questions. And then it's also useful for the conservation effort in terms of learning more about Bwindi gorillas. Bwindi is about 30 miles from the Virunga volcanoes. In between the two forests, there's just farmland. So the gorillas from the two forest areas don't migrate across. They're isolated. And the Virungas is where Diane Fossey and all of her students who followed her did their famous work back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so there's a huge database from the Virungas on what those mountain gorillas are all about. The other half of the world's mountain gorillas that live in Bwindi, we still know very, very little about. So the project is aimed at understanding the gorillas themselves and also looking at the relationship between the chimps and the gorillas.
What are the big questions that you really want to know the answers to?
Regarding the chimps and the gorillas?
Yeah.
I would say the two sets of questions are, first of all, I'm an anthropologist, and so my career is about trying to reconstruct elements of early human life. And the fascinating thing about Bwindi from that perspective is that we know that some of the earliest important things that happened in human evolution happened right in the same geographic area where Bwindi is located, right at the western edge of the Great Rift Valley in East Africa. And we know that there were times earlier in our history when there would be multiple, two, three, or more species of early human living in the same place at the same time, which of course doesn't exist today. So looking at two great apes that live in the same forest, sharing the same resources, is a study that may give us some insight into the relationship among early human ancestors who also had to share the same resources. And then the other part of the research, and actually the reason that I went there and just fell in love with the place and decided I had to be involved in the research effort in some way, is that it's just a spectacularly beautiful and spectacularly interesting ecosystem. As I said, it's a rugged, high mountain range with tropical forest all across it, and the ecosystem itself is fascinating. You could spend many lifetimes trying to learn about the relationships between the plants and animals in this forest. It's kind of the Yellowstone for the African continent. And so given that there has been a very small research presence there over the last couple of decades, it's just an absolutely wonderful place to go and just learn about the world.
When do you think you might feel that it's safe for you to return to Bwindi and resume your research with the chimps and gorillas?
Well, I canceled this trip because the security situation was really just not clear. And in fact, I had originally planned to have my family and my three small children there with me just about the time of the attack, and I'm glad it didn't work out that way. As for the future, I'm planning to go back at the end of this year and move the camp that I've built to the other side of the park, about 30 miles away, to an area that is much more secure where we have other researchers who have gone back and are continuing their work, and there's kind of a research headquarters there. But to be honest, I'm not convinced right now, and I'm not there, so I can't say firsthand, but I'm not convinced that the security situation is going to be better in the long term, because the rebels who attacked, in fact, about 2 weeks before the attack, my assistant and I were sitting around the camp one night talking about the fact that these rebels were just across the border, that we knew they were there, that the Ugandan army knew they were there, and no one believed that they were organized enough to form a militia that would then attack Buhoma, this major settlement that was guarded by park rangers with rifles and so forth. So we knew the people were there. They're still there. There are something like 10,000 to 20,000 in Terahamwe who were ejected from Rwanda after the civil war there in 94 and are now living scattered around eastern Congo across the border from Uganda. So that situation isn't going to change anytime soon. And I have to say that I think that the situation is going to be unstable there for the near term, maybe the long-term future. That's kind of the way that East Central Africa has been for the last decade or so.
Was this a concern of yours when you first went to the park in 1996 to begin your research?
Well, actually, no, because first, we hadn't had any history of any rebel incursions in that part of Uganda. And only later, when I was working there in the camp that we built, as I said, is about 8 kilometers from the tourist center, and it's only about 5 kilometers, so 3 miles or so from the border with Congo. So it's right on the border. And we started hearing about attacks that these Interahamwe rebels, who were living as a kind of a ragtag army scattered through different settlements on the Congo side, were launching attacks across the border into Uganda and raiding villages and taking supplies and occasionally killing someone or burning down a house. And they were doing it really just as bandits who had nothing to eat and had no supplies. So we didn't really think of them as being potentially a paramilitary force that would stage a major incursion that would include, you know, kidnapping or killing. We worried about robberies. And it makes me think twice about setting the project up again, but it's one of those things that the State Department had no travel advisory issued for that part of Uganda, which is unusual considering that they often have advisories issued for places that researchers who live there know to be really quite safe. I mean, I have to say that my perspective on safety in Bwindi is relative, because I feel, having lived in Africa and other developing parts of the world for many years, that living in rural Africa is on the whole a lot safer than living in most American cities. I mean, I live very close to L.A., and I certainly feel safer living in rural Africa than I feel just walking around the streets of any urban area in the U.S. It's like living in a small farming community when you're in rural Africa. And, of course, what changes that is when you have warfare or these kinds of rebel movements going on.
Well, Craig Stanford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And good luck when you return to Africa.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Craig Stanford teaches anthropology at the University of Southern California. He studies mountain gorillas and chimpanzees at a national park in Uganda. This is Fresh Air.